Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org. Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering canoes, kayaks, and advice for anyone wanting to experience solitude on Wisconsin waterways. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. The United States is one of the richest nations on earth, and yet our guest says it's difficult for millions of Americans to make ends meet.
A new book argues that a strengthened American welfare system is a viable solution to many of the U.S.'s financial and social problems.
And with us today is the author of that book, Lane Kenworthy. He is a professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona, and the author of the book we'll be discussing, Social Democratic America. Lane, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
I want to start out with the very first sentence in the book that says something along the lines of, America is a very rich nation. And then it goes on to describe the ways in which we are rich. And, you know, it's an interesting sentence to begin with, because as we all listen to budget news, as we all read the headlines, as we all, you know, see what's happening, sometimes it doesn't feel that way. But it is.
Yeah, it's true. We're, by historical and comparative standards, we're an incredibly rich nation. Hopefully we'll get a good bit richer, and I'm sure everyone wishes we already were. But a lot of the stalemate that you're referring to has to do with politics. And a really important feature of the approach I take in this book is to think about the medium and long run instead of getting too bogged down in what's going on right now. I should say that part of the argument that I advance in the book is that we're likely to become a lot more generous and expansive in our government social programs over the next half century, but I don't actually think that a whole lot is going to happen in the next couple of years.
Yeah, in fact, and we'll be getting into some of those details about what you would like to have see happening. You talk about the problems and so forth. But early on in the book, you talk about some of the things that we need: universal health care, 1 year paid paternal leave, sickness insurance, wage insurance, and so forth. And you say, I've arrived at this list not by consulting the latest edition of the Progressive's Handbook, but by examining the problems we face and the experiences of the world's rich nations in addressing them. And you make a point of saying here that this is not just a predictable laundry list of the left. In fact, at one point you say that anybody who believes that you are with the left on some of these issues is mistaken. And I'm wondering if before we get into the meat and potatoes of this, you could talk about that, because a lot of people are going to see this title, they're going to hear what we're talking about, and they are immediately going to assume a worldview.
Yeah, so I'm a social scientist, and I try as best I can. I do have my own ideological predilections and my own partisan views. But I try as best I can to try to figure out what evidence tells us from, and in this case, my focus is on the experience of the world's rich countries, so about 20 or so nations. And it's quite striking that if you step back and take a little bit bigger picture view, that every single one of these nations has expanded the scope and generosity of an array of government programs over the last century. They've done it to varying degrees. We're close to the bottom of the list in terms of our generosity, but they've all done this, and I think it's for a very good reason, really two reasons. One is that public insurance programs do a very good job in mitigating risks, and in a rich country, a lot of people want to mitigate risk. You can see that during people's life course, for example, the more money they get, the more insurance they tend to buy on their own. And you can see it both across countries and over time within countries. And then the other element there is fairness. So there's lots and lots of disagreement in the United States about exactly what we should do and what type of outcomes or goals we should privilege. And yet, for almost everyone, there's a core belief that as we get richer, we can afford to be fairer. We can afford the manifestation of this is we can afford to spend more money helping those who are less fortunate in a whole variety of ways. And so you, the fact that you see this in the experience of every single one of these countries, I think tells you something very interesting about what society's like and about where we're likely to continue to go.
Let's start out. You devote a chapter to, in fact, it's called What's the Problem? And let's talk about the problems as you see them. As I read the chapter, it appears to me that one of the main issues is that of income, that lots of low incomes out there, and your prediction is that it's not necessarily going to get any better.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I start out by talking about economic insecurity, just the inability to meet your expenses. And having low income is a really important part of this. The other components there are having an unstable income and having a large unanticipated expense. But low income, and we usually use the term poverty, or the debate sort of couched around poverty when we're speaking of low income, remains surprisingly pervasive. There's been a fair amount of attention devoted to this in the last few months with the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, or the Declaration of the War on Poverty. But it's really striking that the average income, for example, of households in the bottom fifth of incomes in the United States is only about $18,000 a year. So that's one in five American households that have an average income, and of course quite a few in that group have less than that. That's a really tough income to make ends meet on. I refer to this as scraping by. And given the wealth of the country, we could be doing better. We know that because we've done steadily better over the last century or so. And again, other countries that have some of the types of programs or more generous versions of some of the programs that I focus on do better in ensuring that those with low incomes, and there are some people with low incomes in all of these countries, but there are fewer of them, and their incomes tend to be a bit higher in countries that do better on these programs.
So one of the things we should have done earlier in the interview is define exactly what social democracy is, and then maybe talk a little bit about how America already has adopted some of these things.
Right. So it's one of these terms that everybody has their own definition for, but I use it more or less in its traditional way, which is to associate it with the goals and aims of social democratic movements and specifically political parties, which have existed mainly in Western Europe. The Democratic Party's never been quite along these lines, although there have always been some elements of it within the Democratic Party. But the idea is simply to use government programs to try to achieve these goals, economic security, broader opportunity, and shared prosperity. Doesn't mean you only use government, of course. I mean, we rely on firms, we rely on families, we rely on voluntary organizations. But it does mean that you rely to a considerable extent on public programs.
And a lot of the examples that you point to are ones that we are familiar with in the Nordic countries, for example.
That's right. Denmark and Sweden are often considered the kind of paramount examples here. Norway, too, although Norway I try not to infer too much from because it's got so much oil revenue that it's really a kind of exceptional country these days. But, yeah, going back to your previous question, it is the case that here in the United States, almost nobody would refer to the United States as a social democracy currently. But think about the distance between the United States now and the United States a century ago. So back in 1915 or 1920, government spending totaled only about 12% of our GDP. That's spending at all levels, federal, state, local. Just before the recession hit, which is kind of the best time to measure because the recession throws these numbers out of whack a bit, government spending was about 37% of GDP. Still a good bit below that of many other rich nations around the world, but that's light years apart from where we were before. And much of that has, not all of it, but much of it has to do with programs like Social Security and Medicare and a whole array of other things that already exist, many of which are quite good and we could simply build on. So if we were to become a social democratic America, we wouldn't have to start from scratch.
And when you talk about addressing some of these issues, and you just mentioned Social Security and Medicare and so on, you do say in your book that it's not probably going to happen all at once, that fits and starts are kind of going to be what we're looking at.
Right. Well, that's certainly been the historical pattern. And I should say we don't So social scientists have put a lot of effort, especially political scientists and sociologists, into trying to understand when and why we do get these advances in the scope and generosity of government social programs. And we really don't have a very good systematic explanation for when and why that's happened. Sometimes the economy's been really bad, like in the Depression. Sometimes it's been really good, like in the 1960s. Much of the time, Democrats have been influential, but not always. Republicans were in charge when the Earned Income Tax Credit, for example, was put in, and Medicaid was expanded in the 1980s. Sometimes unions have been really influential in pushing for it. Other times, social movements, and sometimes they haven't played much of a role at all, and it's been much more of a technocratic process. But what we do know is that little by little, sometimes at very unexpected moments, we have put into place new programs. And usually because they tend to work quite well, that's not always the case, but often is the case, they become popular, and so it's difficult and therefore unlikely for them to disappear. And so we sort of slowly but steadily built part of what I would call a social democratic America.
We're talking with Lane Kenworthy, a professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona, about his book, Social Democratic America. We'd like to hear from you. So what are your thoughts on adopting a social democratic system of government in America? And would a wider social safety net help or harm the U.S. in the long run? Are you for it or against us? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or drop us an email, talk@WPR.org. We're talking with Lane Kenworthy, professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona, about his new book, Social Democratic America, where he outlines how a social democratic system of government could help solve America's social and financial problems. And we're taking your calls now. What do you think about this idea? More government involvement, more government spending, is that the way the future looks to you? Would a social democracy make for a better, stronger America? Why or why not? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That is 800-642-1234. Let's head to the phones right away. We've got some listeners who would like to join in, and we begin with John, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hello. I don't know if you ever heard of Webster Tarpley, but he's got some good ideas, I think, including the one of like confiscating the Federal Reserve Bank, and have that lend money when it's nationalized to the government at 0% interest. And the second is, how can we afford social democracy if we're spending enormous amounts of money for war and militarization of our police state in America, the national security state?
John, thanks so much for the call. And Lane Kenworthy, what about that? That is going to be an argument, and you've got a chapter on objections in here, and that has to be one that you hear often.
Yeah, so it's actually the one that I start with in that chapter on objections and alternatives. It's a key question. So roughly speaking, I suggest that about half a century from now, we're likely to spend about 10% more of our GDP on various types of programs, some of the ones that already exist and various new ones, for example, universal early education. And so how are we going to get those revenues? Well, it's as a technical matter, it's actually not very difficult to do that. The politics will be harder, although, as I've suggested, I'm pretty optimistic in the long run that we'll get the agreement, as we have for the most part over the last century or so. But let me just give you a sense of some of the ways that we could do this. The starting point, I think, is a national consumption tax, probably designed along the lines of a value-added tax. This is very common in Western Europe. In fact, we're the only rich country in the world that doesn't have something like this. We do have it's a type of consumption tax. We do have a lot of this at the state and local level, but it raises a fairly small amount of money, and we could pretty easily add another 5% of GDP or get another 5% of GDP through a national value added tax or some other form of consumption tax. And then there are lots of little things that we could do. Like, for example, returning to the pre-George W. Bush federal income tax rates for everybody. We've already done that for those at the top with the tax agreement last year, but we could do it for everyone. That would get us another 2% or so of GDP. a carbon tax, a financial transactions tax, increasing the cap on the amount of earnings that are subject to the Social Security payroll tax. That's been dropping pretty steadily for the last several decades. We could increase the payroll tax just a little bit, and then in addition add a few new higher, not dramatically higher, but somewhat higher tax rates on for the richest Americans who get an awful lot more money nowadays than they did a generation or even a decade or so ago, and therefore can afford to pay a little bit more. I'm not proposing anything like an 80 or 90% tax rate for those people, but another 4 or 5% higher effective tax rate. All of those things combined would get you to 10% of GDP, which seems unimaginable when you just think of the number 10%, but I do think that we could generate that.
Let's go to James right now. James is with us from Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess you might have sort of addressed this. I guess I'm wondering in your, you know, work whether you've kind of taken into consideration how much pushback there would be against something like this and how people who see the government taxing more even for something that they might support, social programs and such, as being a drag on their, you know, personal incomes and their ability to move ahead in America, you know, those types of issues.
James, thanks so much for the call. And Lane Kenworthy, that is a big question. You know, you've got the Tea Party out there. You've got a real feeling of a frugality within certain parts of the government, whether you're talking federal or state. How do you push back against that?
Well, the Tea Party really is a very formidable obstacle. And if it were to persist in its current form or even get stronger, over the long run, I really do think that that might change the landscape of American politics. But history suggests that it won't. There's been no real active radical wing of either major party that's been able to sustain itself over the long run without in keeping its core approach or its core beliefs that it starts out with. Normally what happens is either it breaks off and forms a third party, and third parties have a very difficult time lasting in our electoral system, or it gets absorbed and integrated into the mainstream of the party that it joins. So my best guess, again, based on history, not just on wishful thinking, is that the Tea Party, in its current form, with its current views and demands, simply won't persist. That doesn't mean it won't be around 5 or 10 years from now. It just means that 30 or 40 years from now, it's very, very unlikely to exist. I think, as I suggested earlier, that right at this moment, there is very, very limited likelihood of any kind of progress on the types of policies that I'm talking about. But we go through phases or cycles in American politics. And I don't think anybody in 2006 would have, or let's say 2004, when George Bush had just been reelected, would have imagined that 5 years later we would have gotten major health care reform in the country.
And we've only got about 30 seconds or so left, but you take the long view and you say, you know, we're going to get there.
Yeah, that's right. I'm very optimistic about policy. I'll restate what you mentioned earlier. I'm not at all optimistic about economic trends in the economy and in society. I suspect that there's going to be more family instability, that wages in the lower half are not likely to rise. We're going to have a very difficult time increasing employment going forward, and that's indeed part of the reason why we're likely to, in the end, again, in fits and starts, move toward more use of public programs.
That was Lane Kenworthy, professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona. He's the author of the book we've been talking about, Social Democratic America, and blogs at Consider the Evidence.